Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And on this episode, we are bringing you an author chat with Sheila Sundar about her debut novel, Habitations. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners over at patreon.com/booksandboba. So head on over if you'd like to become a bigger part of our book club, gain access to our members-only Discord server, as well as monthly bonus podcasts.
Yeah, we had a lovely chat with Sheila about her book, which pretty much focuses on a young academic who moves from South India to the States, and she's, you know, trying to figure out her life like all 20-something year olds, and it follows her up until her 40s. So it follows her as she navigates love, a green card marriage, affairs, single motherhood. There is just so much life in this book.
Yeah, so without further ado, please enjoy our author chat with Sheila Sundar.
And we are here with Sheila Sundar, who is a professor of English and creative writing at the University of Mississippi. Her writing has appeared in the Virginia Quarterly Review, the Massachusetts Review, and many other publications. And we are here to talk about her debut novel, Habitations. Welcome to the show, Sheila.
Thank you so much, Rira. Thank you, Marvin.
Yeah. So as we always like to start off our author chats, we'd love to hear about what your journey was like to become a published novelist. Can you tell us how you became a writer and how you got to write this novel?
Yeah. I had a pretty long path. I was telling a friend earlier today that I had at one point fantasized about being 25 under 25 and then 35 under 35. And now I'm really happy that I was neither of those things. I was a teacher for a good long while before I became a writer, at least in this capacity. And I had, was at the time for years and years, I've probably since undergrad, I was always writing. I was taking writing classes. It was always, I always had the sense that one day I would become a writer, but it never was quite the right time. I never felt that I worked on the craft for over a decade. And I think this might be an important technical detail, that I worked on a novel that I never published, but I poured myself into it. And in the process of working on it, learned so much about writing, learned a lot about what I felt I did well as a writer, but also learned so much about what makes a novel not work. I learned at the end of that process so much about how you shape characters, how you shape voice, how you world build. But I ultimately found myself in my late 30s with a novel that reflected my best efforts over the course of 10 years. And Lisa Koh talks about this a bit in her, like how when you write a novel over the course of 10 years, where it is by the end of it is very different from where it was at the beginning. And so I had a novel there are almost different shades of me in it. The shades of me that started the book, the shades of me that I became a few years into writing it. But I had something that was this like beautiful, beautiful mess. It was just a beautiful mess. There was so much good language in it, so much good character, but it didn't come together as a novel that would, I came to believe, be a success in a traditional sense. I wouldn't publish it. But I really go back to that. I think I've learned to love this novel for what it was. It was just a beautiful mess. And so I had a couple of realizations around my late 30s. One, which was that the novel would not sell. Two, I still wanted more than anything to be a novelist, that I would not be happy in like the fullest, realest, deepest sense. I would not be happy unless I were writing fiction and writing fiction in the way that I wanted to. And I also knew that I had more books in me. So it was a nice and maybe cathartic moment. I shelved the book. I was grateful for what it had given me. And I decided that I was going to take my writing much more seriously. And I was going to apply that dedication to an entirely new project. And I had this woman in the back of my mind, this character in the back of my mind, and a very different version of her, a very skeletal version of her, was kind of like, I don't know, like what sound do bones make in your head? It was clanging about in my head. And so when I realized that I needed the kind of focused environment that would turn me from somebody who wrote a bit to somebody who really was a writer. And I had been putting off an MFA or deciding that maybe I could work around getting an MFA, but I decided in that moment that I would go do that. So I started my MFA at Boston University, which is where I'm sitting now, in Boston. And my family at the time lived in New Orleans. And so I got in and I started commuting back and forth to Boston, and I would come home every other weekend and be with my spouse and my three kids. And then I would go back up, and it was a hard year in that respect, but it was also an incredibly focused year where I came in with the full commitment that I was going to begin what would be at the end a novel that to me captured the skill and craft and voice that I loved in my first novel, but really was a fresh project. And this was that.
It's funny that you say that this book, it took like 10 years of like honing your craft and really like getting to know yourself as a writer, because as I was reading this novel, I was like, I wonder if she would have been able to write this in her late 20s and early 30s, because it follows a woman from her 20s all the way to like her 40s pretty much. And it's like, oh, I wonder like if it took you a long time to write it. And sure enough, it did take you a long time to write it. But before we get into the nitty gritty of the book, your bio says you're a professor of English and creative writing. And I am just curious as to, because like Marvin and I, we are not critics. We're not like publishing professionals. So there's always kind of like this imposter syndrome of like, oh, like I don't like we don't think that we are like the most qualified to review books. So like as like an English professor, like what are some books that impacted you when you were younger and helped shape you as a writer?
Yeah, I don't know if any of us thinks we're qualified. I mean, if you do think you're qualified, you're probably not. The idea that any of us thinks we're qualified to weigh in on stories and the written word, I mean, probably I think the most insecure among us are the best among us. And I think like a lot of us, I devoured books when I was a kid, and they were such a big part of my realization that the world was bigger than my own narrow experience. And I loved it. I mean, I loved the feeling of just being dropped into another story. And as much as I love literature now, I don't think anything can compare to the experience of being a kid and reading. So I always go back to the books that shaped me. And my pivotal ones were the Anne of Green Gables series, which I don't think I could have become anything without those books. And the Mildred D. Taylor Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry series. Those consumed me. They ate me up. And then beyond that, anything by Judy Blume was a pretty big part of my life. I wanted to hang out with Peter Hatcher. I wanted to move to New York and live in his building, and all of these things. You know, I this this, I think I'm borrowing this term from Zadie Smith, and she called herself a voyeur in this regard, but I was just like somebody who always wanted to look in on other people's lives. And I felt with books I was doing that. So there are different books that have made a huge impact on me in later years. Barbara Kingsolver is probably my favorite working writer today. I was profoundly shaped by Jhumpa Lahiri. We're very different writers stylistically, but the permission that she granted herself to write about her own people. And I think for Barbara Kingsolver, the permission she granted herself to step across boundaries of what was hers and what was familiar. Both of those moves, both of those ways of letting yourself go as a writer were hugely impactful for me. And I know more will come up. There's so many books that I just felt like I couldn't have done anything without. But those were really significant. Another individual book that really impacted me was Tiare Jones' An American Marriage. And in both the novel and also some of the conversations that she had following that book, because she talks a lot about writing about issues that have real sociological importance, significance. And she talks about the work of a novelist when you are addressing a societal ill and how what we want to do as novelists is focus on the story. And for me, that was really, really important. I read an interview that she had Paris Review multiple times to almost give myself the permission that I talked about Kingsolver and Lahiri giving themselves. When you are writing about characters who are moving their way through a complex world and are subject to who are the receiving end to some degree of systemic injustice, but are sometimes drivers of it and sometimes bear witness to it, the authorial voice, the sociological voice wants to step in, and you've got to leave that out of the room when you're writing fiction. And so I went back over and over to Tiare Jones's interview and read about the choices that she made in writing An American Marriage and just giving herself permission to focus on the story of the characters without feeling that she was required to make a larger point. The characters were capable of carrying that narrative and making that point for her. So I really valued that.
Yeah, I mean, like, one thing you don't want to do as an author is to just bang like a message onto like your reader's head. Like, you hope that they are smart enough, and readers are smart to catch like all of those allegories and metaphors and what the characters represent and their growth. So for our listeners out there who have not heard about your book, can you give us a brief synopsis?
Yeah. So Habitations is a story of Vega Gopalan, who is at the beginning of the book, a young undergraduate, young graduate student who is just beginning her academic coursework in the field of sociology, has long been somebody who aspired to be a sociologist, has long been somebody who carried this particular intellectual impulse and curiosity. She's also somebody who's grieving the loss of a young sister who died when her sister was 14 and Vega was 17. And that is the shadow that follows her throughout her adult life. And early in the novel, she moves to the United States. She moves to New York City from Chennai to pursue a master's degree at Columbia in sociology, and ultimately stays to get her doctorate. But the novel takes readers through about two decades of her life, from her mid-20s to her early 40s, and explores what it is to make a home, what it is to make an adult life, what it is to be a migrant, an intellectual, how you navigate desires. The novel is very much an exploration of her experience as a mother, and it's the story of an immigrant woman finding home.
Yeah, I would say this book is definitely what I consider to be like a portrait of a woman who is coming into her own identity and like figuring out all the things that we ask ourselves when we are younger, like where do we belong, and like who are we outside of the labels that society gives us. And I like, one thing that I was really impressed by your novel was I guess, like, in writing, we all often hear show, not tell. And but like in your book, there's just so much interiority with Vega's voice, and we're in her head so much. And I just want to ask, like, how did her voice come to you?
Over a long period of time, in the early drafts, she was not as developed because I didn't know her. She was much more of an acquaintance in the early drafts. And I felt that way so much. Like, I need to tell her story, but I was chasing her to figure out who she was. And then with revision upon revision, I felt as though I was able to see her very fully. And so I remember telling one of my graduate professors when I first envisioned Vega that I would know her well when I really knew what kind of snacks she ate when nobody was looking. And at the end of the book, I thought, man, like, I know this woman's snack habits, and which I know sounds small, but there's something about sometimes when we're writing, we have a sense of the big picture of characters' lives. We can tell you where they studied and where they're from, and we can take the reader back generations and trace you through their family history, or take you through their family history, trace their family history. But we don't often know at an intimate level what their fears and desires or vices are. We don't often let ourselves really step into their shoes and imagine them in moments when they are feeling the most vulnerable and the most lost and the most scared. And so I really focused a lot on her desires and needs as I revised the novel. And by the end, I had a real sense of the detail that made her human, the not necessarily compelling detail, not necessarily the biographical information that you would use to describe a person if you were introducing them, which is how I started off the book. I knew that her father was a lawyer. I had a sense of her mother. I knew where she lived. I could tell you where she went to school. I did all of the work that you do at the initial stage when you're getting to know a character. But there was something I knew about her that came upon revision that didn't have to do with the kind of sketch of her life, but had a lot more to do with the quiet desires and fears and the things that she wouldn't necessarily disclose to a stranger and does not disclose to many strangers or even close friends throughout the book. She keeps a lot from other people around her that only the reader is privy to.
Yeah, I feel like you captured all the little pigments of her thoughts very, very well. As you mentioned, Vega is a sociologist, or she's studying sociology. And I'm curious as to, like, why you decide to make her study that. And how does her choice of study provide a lens to the world that she inhabits?
I had read so many novels about immigrant women who moved to the U.S. at a time when their sense of their own country didn't necessarily translate to an understanding of the way that their new country operated. So as smart and savvy and capable as they were at home, they arrived in the States and the rules were different. The political conversation was different. And so I was really curious about when I started to imagine her, I realized that I was craving a character who came to the U.S. and demanded a seat at the table. And had she been that forthright at the very beginning of the book, I don't think it would have been as believable. But she came to the U.S. really believing that she had something to learn and something to say. And I knew always that she was going to be somebody who was a social critic of some sort. And then she just, as I drafted, she became smarter and smarter. And suddenly I was able to imagine the books she had read and the beliefs that she held. And there she's at the early stage of figuring out how she is situated and positioned within Indian society. She's young still, but she has some sense that the system is broken, that it's rigged against some people, that there is pervasive injustice. And she understands that that's not just a misfortune that can be addressed by talking about it or giving a little bit of charity, but that it is by design. It is a systemic injustice that she is starting to understand that surrounds her, that she has not necessarily really been a victim of. But that, of course, is complicated given her sister's medical condition. Once she moves to the U.S., she realizes much of the way in which just being a person from India, being a person from the global South, does actually affect the access that her family has had. But when she's coming of age, she's not someone who just accepts the rules and order of the world around her. And so what I was really excited about was throughout the revision process, she just became sharper and sharper. And then I began to imagine somebody who didn't just stumble upon ideas, but was actively seeking them out, who was really hungry for a more thoughtful approach to understanding the complexities of the world around her. And what was important to me was that when she arrives in the US, she is trying to make sense of it, but she also understands that her job is to make sense of that too. That in the US, the work of figuring out justice and systems of injustice, that's not finished business either. And so I wanted her to jump in and investigate that. And I spent quite a bit of time talking to Indian sociologists and Indian social scientists and trying to understand what it felt like for them to take their sharpness that they were honing at this really, really young age and move that to a different political and cultural context. And once I did speak with them, I realized how fascinated I was by that experience, by being a smart person, a smart woman, a smart academic whose smartness is not defined by national borders.
Yeah. And like Rira mentioned, Vega being a sociologist was a really clever way to fold in discussion of social issues without the book feeling, you know, didactic, because these are just her observations as someone who studies this stuff. And, you know, class and privilege are big themes in your novel. And, you know, reading the book as an Asian American, I couldn't help but think about how even coming to the States, immigrating here for education as a scholar, is a form of privilege in itself. And, you know, it's not my personal immigration story, although I did have an aunt who did come to the States as a scholar. But I do know plenty of people whose American immigration story does start with a family member coming to the States for education. And that's also the case with a lot of the characters in your story as well. So I want to ask, what made you want to tell a story about these immigrant scholars?
Well, I think maybe what I was less aware of, it's the experiences and memories you have that are lodged so deep within you that you don't realize until you're writing that they were how profoundly you're affected by this. But I had a number, I suppose, similarly. I mean, I guess I have a little bit of immigrant scholar background too. My father came to the U.S. as a graduate student in engineering, and then eventually we started coming over. But when I was a teenager, I had a stream of family members, two cousins in particular, who came to the U.S. to study, to get their bachelor's degree in Massachusetts. And so my family lived in New Jersey, and they would come stay with us during holidays. And I became so close to them, and I found them utterly fascinating and utterly unapologetic, and like having these boundaryless lives. And at a young age, I was 13, 14, and my life felt only circumscribed. It felt like I had no control over the rules, the order. And here are these two young women who are studying at Mount Holyoke and were studying whatever they wanted to, had these wild and exciting intellectual pursuits. And I just loved being around them. And I don't know that I was conscious as I wrote Vega of how compelled I was by the world in which they operated then and then continue to operate as they move through the U.S. in their own journeys, and all of the people that they would bring home for the holidays, all the other international students who wanted a place to go for Thanksgiving or Christmas or summer. And but it just seemed like the most badass, ballsy thing you could do, to show up in another country and say, like, I've got something to fucking say. Like, I want to, you know, like, let me in to your women's studies class. I mean, there are so many ballsy ways to immigrate. And I realize we're talking about a very, very privileged experience within a much larger world of people who migrate. But this was the one that I saw, and it remained, I think, lodged within me, this belief that, like, people do this. And I saw people of varied gender backgrounds doing this, but the people that I paid closest attention to were women, and women who had the instincts of social scientists. And I saw the books they were reading. And then when I went to college myself and later grad school, I was always aware of the presence of international students around me. And of course, as an Asian American student, as a South Asian American student, I was very close with all of, I felt a certain cultural kinship with all of the South Asians around me when I went to school. I don't know that I realized I was South Asian until I was suddenly not surrounded by them anymore. And I craved the presence of people whose culture felt somewhat familiar. And that, of course, encompassed a number of international students as well. And I was always just taken in by them. And I was also taken by the found family that so many of them cultivated. And one of them, who is a dear friend of mine in college, is coming to my reading this evening. And that, you know, 20-year friendship is, it's a testament to the power of friendship, which, you know, is a big part of my book as well. But I feel like I was so lucky to bear witness, close witness, to the incredible work that immigrants and immigrant students do to build lives of real worth and meaning and substance and contribution, as well as kinship within the U.S. And I just, whether or not I intended to, I don't know. I wrote so much of my novel became a love letter to those people, particularly to those women.
I mean, we often forget that, like, immigrants and migrants, like, they are very skilled at adapting, but at the same time, they carry their culture with them, and they can be very, you know, like, confident in that culture and be like, you can't, it's like, I know that the society that I moved into is telling me that I have to bow down to their rules of their institution, but I refuse. That's not, it's like, that's not the case where I come from. And as they move, like, their definition of home changes, and each place that they move to, I like, they come out transformed. And you mentioned how you lived in New Jersey and New Orleans, and Vega lives in New Jersey and New Orleans. So I was curious as to, like, how your own personal, I guess, habitations shaped Vega's journey.
Well, I hadn't decided where she would end up after New Jersey. I had a sense, I wanted her to, she settles in Baton Rouge, and I had originally thought, well, maybe I can move her to New Orleans. But for some reason, it just wasn't clicking. I didn't see her there. I didn't quite believe it. And so I saw her in Baton Rouge, which is a place that where I do have family. I do have some family connection. But it was just the kind of landscape where I saw her arriving. It was a place that seemed like there was some feeling of familiarity, because it was, she's back in a place that shares some elements of some common landscape, some common features. The heat is familiar to her. The smells are familiar to her, just by the sort of quirks of geography, that the Gulf South felt more reminiscent of South India than any other place she had lived in the States. But she also, I have never felt like I could control the movement and the geography of my characters' lives. I felt with her, and I feel with my current book now, that they drive that in a way that I can't quite understand. That they are, I cannot put them wherever I want to put them. They kind of let me know what is a logical place is for them. I could not have predicted when I started writing this book, where she would end up finding her final habitation. And maybe if I could have predicted it, it would have been very, very different for where she does end up. But I just, the New York part made perfect sense to me. I just felt that the Vega that I was coming to know was going to end up at Columbia. That was so logical to me. And New Jersey, of course, once she arrived there, I just felt in those chapters like I was sinking into a world that felt in so many ways so familiar to me. I don't know that I could have forced her there. That was where it seemed to make sense that was where she would go. But once she did, I could just write that world that she settled in so intimately and with so much familiarity. And then I felt a little bit of alienation and distance when she ends up in Baton Rouge. But I think one of the beautiful functions of that unfamiliarity was that she too is lost. And so I had spent a lot of time trying to actually map out where she would be, where she would live, where she would go. And but she was doing the same thing. And so I think the Baton Rouge section of the novel is one where she is really looking for kinship and really looking for orientation. And so my sort of tentativeness in those chapters, I think, came through and she reflected what she was feeling as well.
Yeah, I love that you brought the topic of kinship. And, you know, like in the chapters where she is in Baton Rouge, like you can really sense that she is lonely. And because like she's kind of moved away from her support network, she kind of has to start over again. And I feel like you captured, I guess, like the adult problem of trying to keep up with friendships and knowing when to let go of friends, and also just understanding that maybe you've judged too quickly, and maybe those people deserve another chance from you, and maybe they need a chance to like prove themselves to you. Yeah, like, can you tell us a little bit about like how you went about developing those long-lasting friendships, and also the, I guess, like temporary friendships that kind of fade with time?
All of those people felt so real to me. They made so much sense. I believed in their existence, and because of that, it was natural to me that she would hold on to them in the way that she did. Not always aware in the beginning how much they meant. Shoba was, of all the characters, she's somebody I just loved so dearly. And I loved so much watching her change in some ways, but she reflects, I think, more of Vega's evolution. She does change. I mean, Shoba's not a static character, but Shoba's evolution is reflected in the changing nature of their relationship. And there is an insecurity in our early years where we really believe that people's intellectual interests or their cultural interests have to manifest themselves in the exact same way that ours do in order for our friendships to be meaningful. And here are two people who have nothing in common. They would never have been friends in India. And I think that is one of the beautiful things that comes of migration, whether it's, you know, of just moving, is that we depend on people. And I have found in my own life that the friendships that have been dearest to me were not necessarily ones that I could have predicted. They were ones that came after cracking through the exterior of acquaintanceship and coming upon a connection that's real and substantive. In Vega's case, she, I think, is very surprised by how much she comes to love people that she really thought she could keep at arm's length. And I love exploring love in fiction. It's just I don't think we write enough about it. I don't think we read enough about it. I don't think we talk enough about it. But it is so much of the driver for her in finding out where she wants to be. That what she's missing when she gets to Baton Rouge is love that she did not give any real value to when it first slowly started entering her life. These connections that when they were first established were not to her particularly meaningful.
Yeah. And I feel like she's humbled by like being a mother, being a single mother later on. It's like, oh, yeah, it really does take a village. And there are some things that I took for granted from the people around me and the way that they showed love to me. I took that for granted. Can you talk to us a little bit about how motherhood changes Vega and her journey in, I guess, like finding herself?
I think Vega, without much complication, the moment that Asha is born is just profoundly shaped by her and deeply, deeply in love with that baby. And I felt that if I had wanted to push her in another direction, I think it would have read as disingenuous. The reader would have picked up on the falseness of that, because I believed on such a deep level in the depth of Vega's love. And I knew, too, that Vega was ready to care for Asha when Asha came around, and she was ready to consider her as she mapped out her own life. She wasn't fully ready for, she wasn't done raising herself by any means, but she loved her in a way that she did not question or second guess. And I felt that so intensely from the moment of the moment she gives birth in the book and she's holding her. It just, I feel a shift in Vega that is not, which is not to suggest that motherhood changes every single person. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. I mean, I think that's an individual question, but in Vega's case, she was ready to be a mother. And so I think she just delights in the person Asha is, but is also overwhelmed by this hard truth of motherhood that, you know, she makes a comment in early on in the book that she wishes that she could return Asha to the womb, at least until she has a car. And she can't, there's no point at which she can just pause Asha's development and say, hold up, let me raise myself a little bit longer. Asha keeps growing. And so Vega has to keep pace. And so there's the stretches of the book before Asha's arrival and into Asha's infancy where Vega is actively trying to figure out what she wants and how to balance her desires and her fundamental needs and how to shape herself into the adult that she wants to be. And then as Asha gets older, there is the realization that she is now someone who is like, her happiness is tied to this kid's happiness. And she has to get to a place where the two of them just feel really, really good.
Yeah, totally. I wanted to go back to our discussion on the friendships that we make throughout our lives. You know, as someone who has gone to school in different states, lived in several different cities, I could definitely relate to Vega's experience of having to essentially restart her social life every time she moves to a new place or starts a new job. And throughout your novel, she meets a lot of different people. And I'm always curious when reading a book with so many characters, like, how did you keep things organized, like craft-wise? And what was it like writing the story of so many, you know, side characters that, like you mentioned, also grow alongside Vega?
When I knew that a character was real, when I fully believed in them, then they... I can't say they wrote themselves, but I knew what it was like to be in a room with them. And I knew not just how they would interact on the surface, but I knew substantively how Vega felt in their presence. And so much of those moments, those exchanges with Halima and Zamati, with Shoba and with Gayatri, those felt very, very real to me. And I never, I'm not an outlier. They had to stay in my head. But I never lost track of them because I was so aware of how much they shaped Vega that to not get back to them had the same feeling to me that I have when I've fallen out of touch with a friend. And that was when I brought them in. You know, when she reconnects with Halima, and it made perfect sense to me where Halima was at the time, but I just felt like, man, those two need to get back together. Halima has been gone from her life for so long. And then even Winston, I don't think I would have felt okay letting that go. But I also, that to me, it's partly because I don't outline, they have to feel so vivid to me Otherwise, I will not. That my organization is less about structured planning than it is about really, really believing in the characters and where they're going to end up, so that I know I'm not going to lose track of them. But I also am somebody in my own life that just, I don't quite let go of people. I really love knowing where people are. Every acquaintance, every friendship, every ex, like these are people that I've cared about. And I love just check-ins with people. I just need to know that they're okay. I love finding out that somebody I haven't spoken to in a while is like just anything about their lives. That's very meaningful to me. And I've long been aware too that it's like this the magic and happenstance that brings us to cross paths with people is something that really like we should hold on to. So I'm always eager for myself to reconnect with people. And so when Vega moves through people's lives, it would have felt, again, disingenuous, would have felt somewhat false for me to let those relationships go. And there isn't too much of me in Vega, but in this one sense, I really understood why she was comforted by those moments of reconnection. She doesn't initiate them. She's not great at that. And that's, I do much more. And it frustrates me when she's a little bit more hesitant, but she comes to realize why those matter. And to me, I like those people so much that I didn't quite forget about them.
Yeah. Something interesting that I didn't clock until like way too late in the story, just maybe my reading comprehension being slow, is that your story takes place in the late 90s, early aughts, before social media. And that adds an extra layer to like this, you know, the way that we used to connect to people was through physical contact and not through the internet. And for some reason, I didn't catch on until later on when you're mentioning current events happening in real time. Was the setting something that you always wanted to set the story in, or was that there as like a way to kind of facilitate that, you know, the friendship relationships?
It just made sense to me that she would arrive in the 90s, but as I wrote, I very intentionally did not move that arrival date. And at the time, that was logical. I felt it. She felt like a kid of the 90s, she felt like a kid of the late 80s, early 90s to me, but I could have moved that date, certainly made it more contemporary, but it did not feel right to. It actually felt so senseless. It felt so true to her circumstances that she could get in touch with people. Email existed, phone existed, but not with the intensity that it does today. Not with the intensity that drumbeat of contact, of superficial contact that is in our lives today. I knew that wasn't going to be part of her life. And I'd be curious to know how she would navigate this moment. I think she probably would do just fine. But in her most formative years, when she was still trying to understand herself, what it meant to care for people, be cared for by people, she did not have that kind of distant access, that ability to just look from the outside in on people's worlds. So she couldn't have just found out what Naomi was doing without revealing her true intention, which was to find out how Naomi's doing. I mean, the funny thing about the moment we live in now is that we can check in on people without ever having to expose any vulnerability on our part, without ever having to admit this painful truth that we want to actually know how they're doing. But for her, anytime she wants to reach out to somebody, it is a betrayal of emotion. It's a betrayal of need. And so I liked that she had to do that when she did that. And there's also her life is private in a way that our lives have stopped being so private. We can, if we choose to, keep secrets, of course. But the fact of her loss is something that she can choose not to share. The distance between different social groups is something that she's able to maintain. And so in that there's a privacy that she is allowed to have that ultimately it serves her in some moments and doesn't in others, but she's able to hold on to it because of the moment that she's living in.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned that Vega is a very frustrating character to write and surely to read as well. She makes a lot of just frustrating decisions, but you know, you can't help as a reader, you can't help but root for her because you know of her circumstance, you know that, you know, use like, I guess maybe also some projection as like, you know, a child of immigrants myself, you want her to succeed because she's already up against so much and she does deserve love. And a lot of her decisions seems like they're made in search of like love and connection, even if they're not the best decisions. And, you know, they're all rooted from this very early loss of her younger sister before the start of the book. You mentioned she's someone that's so outside of your experience. How was it to write someone who is so driven by like these desires and needs and wants?
Desire is such a big part of her life. And it's funny, I was speaking with a graduate student at the University of Mississippi a couple of weeks ago, and she was saying that when Vega and Winston get together, she was shouting into the book, like, girl, what are you doing? And I thought to myself, like, I was surprised by that because I thought, really, like, I knew exactly what she was doing. And that felt, especially with Winston and Naomi as well, with so many of the characters that she, so many of the experiences that she pursues, particularly romantic and sexual experiences, those felt to me like the most natural extension of her character that I could imagine. I mean, I could not imagine the book had she and Winston had a relationship of any different nature. That so her desires felt so believable to me. So believable that had I diminished them in any way, that would have felt unbelievable to me. I would have felt as though I was not crafting Vega with all the fullness with which she existed in my mind. So I do, she makes some questionable decisions, but I should say that I was more aware of her questionable decisions after writing the book and talking to people about it. In writing it, I had no intention really, I'm interested in flawed characters, of course, I mean, we're all flawed, but I had no intention of writing a flawed character. I intended to write a woman with a lot of desire, intellectual desire, sexual desire, maternal desire, familial desire, and somebody who in her, who acts upon those, most of those desires, and does so even when ultimately they will have some consequence. Not, I don't think she does things with disastrous consequences for other people intentionally. I don't think she's a malicious person. I don't think that she's a person who's indifferent to other people's needs. And I think she's quite sensitive to, she's quite aware that she is one person in a world of many. But she's not going to have an opportunity to act upon a desire and not do it. And she's not going to lie to herself about what's going to feel comforting or good or satisfying. And so that is, I felt at the end of it when I talked to people, oh yeah, I did write somebody who doesn't make the greatest choices. But in the moment, I felt like she was making the only choice that I could possibly have believed she would have made.
Yeah, as like when I was reading her her various relationships, I'm like, oh my goodness, there are so many red flags. And also it seems like she's chasing partners who she knows that they're pretty much unavailable at the very end. It's almost like she's like, you know, cutting that relationship short. She's just like, well, it's not going to work out anyway. And that's what makes the relationship so appealing.
But I also understand the want to have a partner where you can talk about things with in an intellectual way, right?
Yeah.
I totally get that as well.
So we are winding down to the end of our chat. And I like really wanted to ask this because as someone who, you know, is not part of academia, it's kind of like a very, it's just like an interesting realm shrouded in mystery. But for BIPOCs in academia, they're in like this very strange place where a lot of universities, they have like institutionalized racism. They're built on like colonialism. And it's like, how do you like inhabit that like space that is so hostile to you as like a person of color? And but at the same time, like it gives you a perspective that you may have not had it if you had stayed in the motherland. For example, when Vega returns home after graduation in the States, she can't help but reflect on her own privilege as a Brahmin in India. And that's not something that she would have probably picked up on or at least she wouldn't have picked up on it like that early on in her life had she not moved out of her hometown. Can you tell us a little bit about how she begins to understand the space that she inhabits in academia?
Well, I think, you know, I think she would have picked up on the way caste influenced her life in India. But what she would never have had access to is in any sense of how caste continues to impact her life, continues to follow her, even in the US, that she benefits from access to elite institutions. So the proximity to whiteness that she is granted in the US is very much a function of caste. And that is something that she wouldn't have been positioned to even see. So, and she's also coming to the US at a time when the sort of paternalism and charity of being a do-gooder is falling out of fashion. And it is something that is being replaced by a call for much more systemic change. And so she's just at an interesting moment when what does it mean to be a thoughtful, decent person in the world, aware of your privilege, and also sometimes wanting to recognize that there are limits to that privilege too, as somebody from the global South and as somebody who has brown skin living in having proximity to whiteness, but also ultimately living in a very white world. I think my own personal experience in academia has been pretty rosy. I work in a really wonderful institution, which I when you say that, you know, University of Mississippi is this, like, I wouldn't say it's necessarily university wide, always a bastion of progressive thought, but it is. But I have a department that is wonderful and smart and committed and rambunctious and interesting. And I just, I have a really, really fortunate position within a landscape that I think for a lot of people of all backgrounds, but certainly people of color, certainly queer folks, certainly immigrants is a complicated place. And so I, as you know, in my own narrow experience, I can say that I love teaching. I love the department that I'm part of. I love the university that I'm part of. I love my students dearly. And I began my own career as a professor when the book was finished. So I could have made some changes, but really, like, the texture of Vega's life as an academic was written into the novel before I became an academic myself. But I think in a lot of ways, what she loves about teaching and she loves about being part of any university does reflect the things that I too love about it, that there's just a beauty to teaching students. There's a beauty to having them walk in the room and be part of the conversation that you're facilitating. It's a real privilege I think she's aware that it's a real privilege to do that. And I have felt the same way in my own experience.
Yeah. Well, your book just came out earlier this month. How has it been seeing it out in the world?
It's so wild. I mean, I'm in Boston right now and giving a reading this evening at Brookline Booksmith. And I walked in and it was just there. It was just a book among books. And like, that's wild. It's such a joy to see it up there. And it is something, like, it is such a gift to write something that people consume for pleasure and thought and connection, human connection, connection to themselves, connection to others. And I cannot believe that I've had the opportunity to do that. I'm still over the moon. If you ask me in 10 years, I might still be riding this high. So I don't know if it's just the moment or like the feeling of publishing, but yeah.
Well, congratulations for reaching your dream. Are you up for doing it again, or are you going to take a little break for now?
No, I'm into book two, and it is I'm loving it so far. I can say that it is unless something significant changes. I guess what I can commit to saying about it is that it's a story of a diplomatic family in the early aughts and spanning about 15 years.
Well, Sheila, thank you so much for joining us on Books and Bulba, and congrats on your book launch.
Thank you, Marvin Urrea, so much.
And that was our author chat with Sheila Sundar. Her debut novel, Habitations, is available now at booksellers everywhere, including, as always, the Books and Bulba bookshop, where you can find all the books that have been covered on our podcast through our book club or author chats. And don't forget that any purchases made on the Books and Boba bookstore support not only our podcast, but also your local bookstore. So definitely check it out on the bookstore link on booksandboba.com. All right. Before we call it an episode, though, Rira, can you please remind us what we are reading for Book Club for the month of April?
Yeah. So this month was a patron's choice. And among the list of suggestions, we picked Yellowface by R.F. Huang. This is our first time reading a second book from the same author. And I just like, we picked Yellowface because it's been on our TBR pile for a very long time. And as a book club and podcast that focuses on Asian Americans in publishing, it just seemed like it was just a matter of time that we would have to talk about this book.
Yeah.
So for those of you who are unfamiliar with Yellowface, it's pretty much about a white woman who steals the manuscript of her deceased Asian American writer friend, who was way more successful than her as a writer. So it's a satire, obviously, because we're talking about dead people here. But I'm sure we'll have a lot of things to discuss.
Yeah, definitely looking forward to discussing this book with you at the end of the month. And as always, if you've already finished the book and have thoughts to share, please let us know on Goodreads or Discord. And finally, if you are a Patreon supporter, please join me tonight on Discord, where I'll be discussing the first 8 chapters of Yellowface. This is something new I'm trying out for our Discord. So if you are one of our Patreon supporters, please join and love to hear your thoughts about the book so far. But with that, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you once again to Sheila Sunder for joining us, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hello, I'm Phil Yu, and I'm the host of All the Asians on Star Trek, the podcast in which I interview all the Asians on Star Trek. I'm talking to actors, writers, directors, stunt people, background extras. You know, all the Asians on Star Trek. Find out more at alltheasiansonstartrek.com. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective. Live long and prosper.